I usually just start bragging about what a big star I am, and that really infuriates me. Like, I've never heard of you. Why do you keep saying you the volleyball had a bigger part than you in Castaway?
Well, that's probably true. So glad to have this next guest on with us. You've seen him. I mean, you've seen him in a ton of films, the TV show Justified, which I know a lot of you out there love. And he's actually directing the new film, Gosnell Movie. You can check out more at gosnellmovie.com. Why am I introducing him? Nick Searcy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Stephen. I can't imagine how excited you must be.
Well, you're right. You can't imagine it. So we're glad to have you on. I mean, listen, so we did the introduction. Now that the formalities are out of the way, I'm trying to think of where we met initially. Would it have been through Breitbart somehow? It's one of those things where you just sort of miss it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it was through Andrew. Yeah, we were probably at some gathering or other, and I had seen some crazy video you'd done or something, and then I came up and said hello. I remember introducing myself to you.
You did? You introduced yourself to me?
I think so, yeah. Wow. I mean, you were very disrespectful, I remember.
Well,
you
yeah.
I was. You
that,
know,
that goes without saying. I think I remember it, actually. That yeah. was the function, the secret meeting, where funny, Clint Eastwood was there, I remember.
Yes.
And I don't know if I ever told you, like, there's a certain level. I'm pretty comfortable around. I mean, you know, there are a lot of celebrities working in the entertainment industry. As I'm sure you're comfortable with them. But there's a certain level of celebrity with which I don't know how to interact. And I remember Clint Eastwood, I literally turned around and he was right there. And I just said, hi, I'm Steven. And he said, I'm Clint. And I was really like, okay. I just shook his hand and left. And I remember my friend was playing on his phone. And when Clint was walking out, I remember this clear as day. He looked at me and said, so, did you rescue the princess? That was my Clint Eastwood story. Yeah. But
the funny thing is, I was actually at a function this week, one of those secret functions, and I had to do an introduction on stage. I was introducing the speaker. And when I got there, they put me at a table, and right beside me was Clint Eastwood. And I just froze. I didn't even know what to say. I was like, hi, Mr. Eastwood, I'm Nick Searcy, you know, and that was it. And
right.
And I was so preoccupied with, like, thinking about, oh, no, I should have made a better speech because these jokes are terrible and I'm going to bomb in front of Clint Eastwood.
It does. It changes the level of pressure. I mean, it's, what do you yeah. say to him when you have that body of work? Like, hey, I loved you in Every Which Way But Loose.
Right. Nobody has ever worked with an orangutan like you have.
Clyde was no joke. There's, I even like, I got a kick out of Every Which Way You Can. I'm not even going to lie. The funniest yeah. part of that film is where Clint Eastwood, for those of you who haven't seen it, he knocks a man out with a bass. The fish. Just fishing. He's just completely, anyway, we can get into it. And he beats the crap out of women in all those Dirty Harry films. A lot of people just skim over those parts.
That was the peak for Clint, I think. I mean, you know, and just in terms of acting is that period. But, you know, now he's surpassed all of that. Yeah, it's like you can't say anything.
Well,
it's
and
like,
listen, right. And he's outwardly conservative, so people know that. And people know if they follow you on Twitter. Is it real Nick Searcy on Twitter?
No, it's Yes Nick Searcy.
Yes Nick Searcy. Okay, even yes. even more presumptuous.
Yes, Nick Searcy.
Yes, it is. It is I. So you're out of the closet as a conservative. So I'm not. You know, I don't want to ruin any careers here. But
that's already ruined. Don't worry.
Well, you're doing pretty well. Well, it's interesting you say that because people do talk right about the blacklisting, and I know coming up, you know, before I had my own platform, that I had experienced it. But I do tend to believe that sometimes people blow their victimization out of proportion. Sometimes, the more time I spend around conservatives in Hollywood, I don't see that as the case. Have you felt that pushback a lot? Because you're so vocal.
Well, you know, I wouldn't know it, Stephen. I mean, I don't feel it from, you know, my agents or my managers or anybody like that. I don't hear it from them. I don't know what people are saying about me behind closed doors. If you don't get a role, they don't call you up and tell you why. So
right.
I don't know. It could be happening, but frankly, I don't care because I'm old and, you know, I'm fine.
You're not old. You're a character actor.
But what I'm saying is I'm kind of like reached the point where, you know, I can work with the people that I want to work with, and I don't have to work with people who don't want to work with me anyway. So that's fine.
It's what John Goodman called in The Gambler, the remake, the screw you position. I'm obviously paraphrasing here because of the SEC. Yeah. Yeah, but
exactly. I'm kind of there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Justified, what is it? Six seasons?
Six. Okay. We did six full seasons, yeah. And that was, I mean, what a great experience. And you know, that's the longest series I've ever had, you know, which is great at my age. You know?
Yeah. No, I can imagine. And, I mean, well, let's just be honest. It's not that we're, but at six seasons, you know, with a show, obviously, it puts you in a pretty good position, not only professionally, financially, where a lot of actors don't really have that luxury. And people know you when they see you. And Justified, so let me ask you about that. So you're on the set of Justified. Do you ever get into it with any of your co-stars and just, I mean, do you ever get into it as aggressively as you do on Twitter with the Hollywood libs on that set? That ever happen?
No, they know better. You know, a couple of times it happened early on, like in the pilot. I got into it with not in a terrible, mean way, but you know, so I won't say who it was, but one of the stars said something about it was back when David Letterman made a joke about Sarah Palin's daughter getting
an A-Rod,
sex with A-Rod or something, yeah. And you know, and they kind of poo-pooed that, and I said, wait, you got a daughter, right? You know, you think it'd be all right if David Letterman made a sex joke about your daughter? And so we kind of chewed on that for a few minutes, and after that they all went, okay, don't talk politics with Nick, he's crazy,
right? Yeah. Listen, he's old. I can't be held accountable, I'm just gonna steal stuff.
Right. But you know what happened, you know, is that basically by the end of the show everybody kind of knew, you know, right, where I stood, and they actually wrote it into the show. I mean, in right, like season five, they had
Art. Well, hold on. We have to go to break. I want to talk about that when we get back. Nick Searcy, Ladder with Crowder. Back with the one and only Nick Searcy. Yes, Nick Searcy on Twitter. And Nick, before we left, you were going to tell us a story. So you were in this show Justified, and obviously I don't want to typecast you here, but that's just a show that so many people love. Mm-hmm. And you said that, I mean, they wrote it into the show, right? It was season five?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what happened was in season four, you know, there was this moment where Rush Limbaugh sort of mentioned the show, mentioned Justified on the air, and he mentioned me by name. He said, you know, I was glad to see Art Mullen back. Nick Searcy plays Art. He's one of my favorite characters. So I wound up, you know, through a series of, like, my friends tweeting me and going, oh, my God, Rush Limbaugh said your name. And then I tweeted David Limbaugh, and he, you know, basically I went on the show the next day, and Limbaugh interviewed me for about 12 minutes, you know, which was longer than he interviewed Dick Cheney, by the way. And,
but well, anyway, I think Dick Cheney just hung up. Ah, what do you want? Click.
But anyway, that kind of aired. And then a couple of weeks later, one of the writers saw me and he said, you know, we listened to your Rush Limbaugh interview in the writer's room. I said, oh, really? What'd you guys think? They said, well, we talked about it, and we think you should do it again if you can. Yeah, because I'm bringing in all that audience that you guys have been driving away for years.
Right.
But then in season five, they wrote a scene where my character is sitting in a truck on a stakeout, and he's listening to Limbaugh on the radio.
Right.
Which is, and then, you know, I think it's the first time in television history that a character has actually listened to Limbaugh during a show and then not immediately gone and strangled a puppy or like raped somebody or done something awful. You know? So
right,
it was just sort of like a normal guy listening to the radio.
Right. And, you know. Yeah. Because after all, the people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, the 20 million, must be 20 million neo-Nazis, of course.
That's right.
Now, do you think that was, so right, what drove their decision? Do you think it was just economics where they go, hey, this is a big audience and we don't need to alienate them? Or do you think it was just kind of a throwaway? They thought it was cool. I mean, what's their motivation? Because we know they lean to the left.
Well, you know, I think really their motivation was accuracy. I mean, they've spent a lot of time in Kentucky. They've talked to a lot of the marshals that, you know, right, and they, and, you know, the, I mean, let's face it, it's like there's let's just say there's a higher percentage of conservatives among U.S. marshals than there are among Hollywood liberals, you know, right, Hollywood, sure, and movie business. So I think they were just sort of being accurate. And it seemed right to them that, you know, a person like Art Mullen would probably listen to Rush Limbaugh.
That's a good point. Very fair point. That actually, funnily enough, is sure to not anger anyone. We need to get you your Twitter persona out here just to make sure that you're throwing bombs.
Oh, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Well, okay. So Justified, obviously. I mean, you have such a body of work. So let's talk about what you're doing now. You know, we just had Anne McElhinney on the show last week.
Oh, good.
And or two weeks ago, she was talking about the fracking thing and the Ferguson play in particular. But Gosnell movie, you know, broke all the records for Indiegogo, over $2 million raised. And then Klavan was named director, Andrew Klavan, writer, and you are director. So how did that happen? And I mean, there's a big difference between, right, just discussing a Letterman joke on set and doing something this bold. What's the reaction been like?
Well, how it happened was that, you know, Anne and Phelim and I have been friends, and I sort of was involved in the fundraising campaign a little bit, and they asked me to recommend some directors, and so I recommended a couple of people, and they met with them, and, you know, for whatever reason, they were too busy or, you know, they didn't want to do a movie this grim. And, you know, they came back and said, "Do you know anybody else?" And I said, "Well, you know, I directed a movie a few years ago. Would you like to see it?" You know, I showed them a movie I directed almost 20 years ago. And they, you know, they watched it. We had a couple of meetings after that and they decided to go with me. I sort of felt like after talking to them that I really could direct this movie. And so I kind of, the more I thought about it, the more I felt like it was calling me. So
right. What's funny when you say talk with them, we'll get back to the grim subject matter in a second, but when you say talking with them, it usually means talking with Anne, because I love Phelim, but on the phone, I can never understand a word he says on the phone.
I'm the same way. I have to go, what? What? Do we have a translator?
Right. Well, they both have accents, right? But when you talk to Phelim on the phone, it's mumbling, and you sit there, it's kind of like sitting there like the movie Snatch. And then, but Anne, even though she has the accent, she enunciates it perfectly because she's very clear about it. So I'm like, okay, Anne, I can understand you on the phone. Phelim, I love you, but I have to speak with you in person so I can read lips.
Right. That's a very good impression of Anne.
Oh, thank you. Hopefully they'll still be friends after that. Now you do talk about this, right? The grim subject matter. I mean, people talk about actors, you know, going into method acting. And listen, sometimes it's a little overblown, but you do definitely, in a way, submerge yourself into the project you're working on, right? You're talking about 22-hour days. A lot of people don't realize the amount of work that goes into a film. Have you had to guard yourself, or do you find yourself getting into a depressive state and dealing with Gosnell? Because I can't think of anything darker.
Yeah, I mean, especially at the beginning. I mean, you know, in the opening, when we started really working on the script and turning it into a shooting script and really visualizing it, it's very difficult because it's a movie that you have. It's also a movie that you can't see everything that you're talking about because people just wouldn't be able to take it.
Right.
So you kind of have to find a way to tell the story without it being a festival of gore or some sort of exploitative looking, you know, horror film, you know. And so we managed to make it, I think, into a really compelling crime drama and a courtroom drama, which is more about the, you know, the detecting him and arresting him and convicting him. And it's not so much about, I mean, of course, the darkness of what he did is part of the story, but it's not the main part of the story, let's say.
Of course, for those listening or seeing this right now, Kermit Gosnell, of course, a famous abortion doctor who, I mean, really, there's no other way to put it, a mass murderer by anybody's standards. Yeah. So that's got to be tough to deal with. And like I said, I mean, sometimes people, and I know, I mean, don't you have acting classes?
No, I have a public service acting school, which is just it's just video classes, which I offer free of charge as a public service to America.
Oh, okay. Very nice.
With Nick Searcy. You can find it on YouTube.
This is true. Well, this is one thing. Okay, well, we're talking about Gosnell. Let's get off because it gets too serious. But one thing, though, when people, they can be so self-aggrandizing. I mean, we talk about wanting to be accurate, right? And that's true. But then when you have actors, and I've had friends like this who are going, you know, I'm playing a cop, so I went on a ride-along. I'm going, you think that you know what it's like to be a cop? Because you went on a ride along, not in Detroit, in Grosse Pointe. Like, there is a certain level of self-importance, don't you think, that comes with, even though it's hard work, actors sometimes who make it seem a little bigger than it needs to be?
Yes, absolutely, Stephen. But, you know, I mean, that's true of a lot of actors, not of me, of course.
No,
I'm not a self-aggrandizer. And I have every right to be, you know, and I don't choose to.
No. Well, there's nothing you could say that would be self-aggrandizing short of calling yourself a demigod.
That's true. It's not bragging if it happens to be true.
Well, like an example, right? I got into an argument when the Heath Ledger thing, the Joker, came up. So first, let me preface this. Probably one of the best performances ever in cinematic history. I went in ready to hate it because I thought there's no way he's going to top Jack Nicholson. You know, he's a hipster, blah, blah, blah. Like, this is just a bunch of hype. And I left saying, wow, that's amazing. But what did bother me is when it came out, the story, right, of how he passed away, which is tragic, even more tragic that he left children behind. They go, well, it was just the role consumed him. He was the Joker for, you know, 9 months after that. And I'm going, really? Because I've been in enough film sets in my life. You believe that when they yelled cut, he was going to the craft services table going, can I have a ham sandwich? I mean, it doesn't happen that way.
Right. I do think that is overblown. I think, and every actor's different. I mean, some actors live in that role, you know, because they feel like they have to. And some are, you know, like me, when I just, you know, that good enough? Okay.
The check's still six figures, right?
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, we haven't lost my address, have we? Good.
Well, don't say it out loud because I'm sure there are people who would love that address right now and send you some white powder in the mail.
Oh, well, I get a lot of stuff in the mail. You wouldn't believe it.
Do you get actual, like, physical fan mail?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. You know, on the internet now, you can find anything, you know, so I get, you know, people send me, it's pretty harmless, you know, people send me pictures to sign, usually with a self-addressed stamped envelope, and, you know, as long as the letter that they write me is grammatically correct, I usually fulfill the request.
What? You ever get anything? I mean, I've never gotten physical mail because I keep everything under wraps. Have you ever gotten something a little weird? I mean, because I would picture somebody who – sending an email anyone can do, but someone who takes the time to, you know, lick the envelope or, you know, stamp it with an old rubber seal, the screw loose.
Right. Yeah, I get – you know, I've gotten some prank calls. You know, I've gotten some anonymous, like, envelopes with, like, you know, I hate you. Why don't you shut your mouth? You know, old man, I hope you die soon. You know, stuff like that.
These are actually very, at one point in history, that would be shocking, but compared to the YouTube comments section, that's incredibly friendly. You old man, it's a lot milder than Jew fag, which I get every day. We literally, the last interview we did, and I don't know if we're going to have to bleep this where it's syndicated terrestrially, we talked in the interview. It was with Andrew WK. We talked about people calling me a Jew fag, even though I'm not Jewish or gay. And then literally like eight comments down, someone who clearly didn't watch the video, you and Andrew WK are a couple of Jew fags.
Yeah.
It's just a horrible place.
It really is, you know. But I always just tell them, hey, good luck in the seventh grade, you know.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, well, you're a pretty bright guy. And obviously, you know, conservatism lends itself to that. And you play it up. Like, I just got corrected today where we were talking about the, you know, Lord of the Flies conch shell. And someone was like, it's conch shell. I mean, how do you handle, because you get so much of that. And I'm sure it's even worse in person on set. As a smart guy, do you just have to brush it off? Or do you actually take time to correct everybody?
You know, I don't get it much on set. I mean, people don't come after me in person. You know, they don't have the balls to do that, really. You know, but on Twitter, I just try to you know, have fun with it and just, like, you know, make fun of people that are attacking me.
Yeah, I mean, you're one of the few people. You go the school of Andrew, where you retweet it and you know you deal with it head on and you deal with it through humor.
I usually just start bragging about what a big star I am, and that really infuriates. Like, I've never heard of you. Why do you keep saying you the volleyball had a bigger part than you in Castaway?
Well, that's probably true.
Yeah, it's true. He had more close-ups. But
well, he also had the furthest shot I've ever seen in film. Wilson!
Right. But I always just tell him, you know, you really hurt my feelings. I'm going to have to go swim in my nice, fabulous pool now.
Right. Is it a saltwater pool? Chlorine.
It's saltwater.
Oh, gosh.
It's more expensive, but I'm rich. You know, right?
You're literally pouring salt water on the wound. Let's keep you for one more segment so we can get back to more poor stuff. Nick Searcy, we'll be right back. We are back. Nick Searcy, thanks for staying. I mean, I don't even know where to take it from there, but gosh, it is, it's funny. I mean, there was a time where people like you, though, even if these people say, well, you're not a big enough star, Wilson was a bigger star. I mean, listen. Okay, we're being honest. You're not Tom Hanks, right, from Castaway, but people know you when they see you. And Twitter has changed the level of accessibility with right. people like you. There used to be a point where I feel like if anyone saw you, they would be so starstruck because you see anyone in a film, you know, it's, oh my gosh, that guy's a film star. And now with Twitter, since they can directly insult you all day, do you feel like that's sort of taking away some of the mystique of Hollywood?
Yeah, absolutely, I do, and I'm not so sure that's a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's sort of like Hollywood has always sort of through the years sort of sold itself as this, like, you know, look at these royal people who are movie stars, and you know, everybody needs to, you know, they treat them as something other than human, you know, and basically, you know, we're all just people. Even if I have more money than you, you know, I'm still just a person, you know?
Right.
So, and Tom Hanks has more money than me and he's a person. And, you know, it's like acting is just a job, and it happens to be a job that if you get very lucky, it can pay you very, very well. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, it's just a job.
Right.
I'm not so sure that it's, I think the democratization that has happened with Twitter is not necessarily such a bad thing.
Well, I think that's a good point. We are all human, except for agents. They're subhuman.
Right, right. Absolutely.
That goes.
And managers even worse. Manager.
Oh, my gosh. What's always funny is, you know, I mean, I've been with, you know, William Morris Paradigm, and the agents who come in, their sales pitch. I don't. Have you ever gotten this one where it's like, well, we're agents, but we act very managerially?
Yes, I have heard that phrase. Yeah, yeah. Like, well, we function more like managers,
right?
Like, that's us. You know?
And you're like, oh, so I don't need a manager? No, no, you should still have a manager and give them a cut.
Yeah, and a lawyer, and
right?
A publisher. Yeah,
yeah.
But we're gonna answer the phones for you, okay?
Yeah, I mean, that is true. That's one thing. I, you know, when I went out in the entertainment industry, I remember when I went out to L.A. You know, and I had a few roles right away. Clip along. There's actually a good story. We can maybe talk about the Actors Union. I wasn't allowed to step foot on set of ABC Family's Greek, even though I had been in a union in Canada since I was 12 years old. And it's supposed to be, you know, reciprocated with ACTRA as Canadian and SAG. And they said, well, it is, but it's like a several thousand dollar fee. I said, well, okay, just take it out of my check. You know, you'll get that in the first episode here. I said, no, 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 you have to pay it up front. So my brother, fortunately enough, was one of the first YouTube partners. He made, like, he had a video get 7 million plays, and he lent me the money, and I paid him right back as soon as I did the role. But I mean, think about it. That really is the entertainment industry, and I think this sort of – it does stem from this narcissistic liberal mindset. I hate to politicize it. They do eat their young. Do you feel like that's a real problem?
Eat their young in what sense? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, they just they can't – I mean, there's no one who comes out of that industry as a general rule who comes up – through the system. I mean, you're already successful now. You're an older gentleman, but it just seems to destroy young people. Like, it's corrosive to the soul. I mean, maybe it's just me, but I feel like that's a noticeable trend.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to start in this business, you know, as a child or a young adult. And if you get a lot of success early on, you know, it's all based on what you look like at a certain point in your life. And right. if that right. look changes to the point that it's no longer marketable, and you still think you should be treated the way you were treated when you were royalty because you were on a television show, it can really mess you up, you know. And I, you know, I think that's true to some degree at any stage. I didn't really get started in the film business until I was 31 or something. Mm-hmm. I'd done a lot of plays, but I never.
Well, how did that happen then? I mean, most people at that point are winding down. If they haven't hit their home run by that point, they're packing their bags. What's the story there? 31, Nick Searcy.
Well, actually, I was thinking of packing my bags. We had been in New York, my wife and I had been in New York for a long time. And, you know, I'd done a lot of plays, but never gotten a film career started. And then she came up pregnant somehow. I don't know how that happened. But we decided we couldn't have the baby in New York City, so we moved back down to North Carolina. I was thinking of going back to school and maybe getting a master's degree or something. I got a little agent in North Carolina, and since I'd been in New York, you know, they thought I was something special, so they sent me out a lot. And there were a lot of movies that were shooting in North Carolina back then. I sort of got a little part in Days of Thunder, a little part in Prince of Tides, you know, some other things that came in. And then I wound up reading for a little part in Fried Green Tomatoes. And John Avnet, the director of that movie, said, I want to read Nick for Frank. And I ended up reading for the main villain and got that part eventually in Fried Green Tomatoes. And that sort of gave me enough of a profile that I could.
Now, was 1 hour photo before or after that?
After that, way after. Yeah.
Okay, that would make sense. I remember seeing it going like, hey, I don't remember Nick was in that. You know, that happens.
Yeah, that was 2000. I think Fried Green Tomatoes was 1991. That's kind of when it all started for Nick Searcy.
That's when it all started. Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. That was me with Montreal. I started when I was 12, but I was fired at 14 because my voice changed. Doing voice work.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. It's like you just sort of grow out of something and they're like, well, okay, we don't need that anymore.
Which I would think, you know, for me, it bred a really strong conservative worldview. I mean, I was raised in a Christian household. So that no one can say I was raised Christian. You have to choose at some point. Everyone does. But then what happened was, you know, being fired at 14 and sink or swim and going out in auditions and the rejection, I thought like, well, this isn't fair. Life isn't fair. And I'm just going to have to keep swinging the bat and be okay with failing. And I thought they shouldn't be able to take half of my money once I do make it. Literally, as a 13-year-old, I'm watching my Arthur checks. And I was amazed that not everyone in the entertainment industry felt that way going through those experiences.
I know. I mean, yeah, it is confusing. I don't see how they think that that's fair. That you know, you struggle to try to build something. You starve. You work odd job trying to build a career, and then finally, when you build one, they start going, "Oh, congratulations! I'll have half."
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but it seems like
there should be more outrage.
Yeah. Yeah, there definitely should be, and you know, I'm not a huge fan, obviously, of unions in general and SAG. That was a real ordeal for me when I switched over from Canada to the United States. But same thing, Montreal had a big film industry like North Carolina. Or was it North Carolina or South Carolina, you said?
North Carolina. People in South Carolina don't really travel much. They can't really cross state lines.
Yeah, it's tough to do with those. What do you call those things on the trains that you have to manually pump on the train tracks?
Car. Yeah,
so. Yeah, that's how they get around. And what's funny, I don't know if you've ever shot anything in Montreal, but it was a huge hotbed for film because, you know, you have Old Port Montreal. You can make it look like London. You can make it look like Paris. And then you can make it look like New York City. And then the unions came in and said, oh, there's this big industry. We can tax them more. And they tax themselves out of a huge industry. They don't shoot in Montreal anymore.
Yeah, and that's what's happening in California. I mean, you know, every movie that's I mean, if you're Iron Man, you can shoot wherever you want because right. No matter what the tax rules are or the union rules, it doesn't matter. But if you're a budget of $5 million or less, you just almost cannot shoot in California because of the tax benefits and the conditions in a right to work state. It makes your money go so much farther. And so the entire film business is right now is in Atlanta.
Right.
You know? And if they're not in Atlanta, it's because Atlanta's too full and they're spilling over into other areas. You know, everybody's fleeing California.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think there'll be a rebound effect? Do you think kind of like with I see now in my generation with feminism and the anti-gun crowd and the political correctness, there's been a rejection of it. There's been a rebound a little bit. Do you think that'll happen with the entertainment industry because it's destroying itself in California?
Well, one can hope, but I think what's happening in California is like all the sensible people are leaving. It's like I'm stuck here like with all these morons, you know, and like I can't leave because my wife and daughter love it here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you know, my daughter kind of just considers it her home, and even though she's grown, I'm not going to move away from her. You know, she doesn't live at home, but I don't want to be in a separate state from my daughter. You
right.
Know,
so. Now, how many children do you have?
I have two. I have a 25-year-old and a 15-year-old.
Right, and the 15-year-old is the boy.
Yeah.
Now, you don't talk so much about. I'm not revealing any private information by talking. I mean, he's an adoptive son, right?
Yes, yes. We adopted Omar when he was 15 months old.
Okay. So Omar, so I'm guessing he's not Scandinavian.
No, he's not. He's African-American or black, as some would say. And you know, he's we adopted him when we lived in North Carolina.
Gosh, that makes it tough to go with the racist narrative as a conservative. But you know what's funny? And I will say this, and I was guiding you there, because I remember seeing a tweet to you, something like that, saying, oh, you know, yeah, why don't you show us your black son again to prove you're not racist, you know? And liberals say that like, oh, this is just, yeah, that's not, you're going to bring out your black friend or your black son to prove you're not racist. And just because they say that, it doesn't make it any less valid of an argument. Because the fact is, it is a Trump card. You clearly aren't racist. Right. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I always, yeah, when they start that with me, I always tweak them back. I go, think about how prescient I was to 14 years ago adopt a black child because I knew I would need him as a tool to fight liberal.
That's what you so dumb. You filled it out in the questionnaire. And the reason for adopting child? Trump card. It's your ace in the hole against the race card. No, but it's true. And a lot of conservatives back away like, oh, well, I don't want to say I'm not racist because I have a lot of black friends. Or I don't want to say I'm not racist because, you know, I've adopted. But the fact is, it is an example of by racism by definition. You wouldn't be close to someone if you hated them based on race. And I remember reading that going, I don't remember. It might have been on Twitter. You could maybe correct me. And I remember reading it going, yes, it does. It does prove that he's not racist.
Well, you know, it's funny thing about transracial adoption. I mean, liberals really have a big problem with it. They don't want to admit it, and the reason they have a big problem with it, the reason that they have so offended by the fact that I happen to be proud of my son Omar, is that they themselves can't imagine doing that. They can't imagine adopting a child of a different race, and they're projecting that onto me. Right. And I just laugh at them and just make fun of them and throw it right back in their face. And that's why I'm hilarious.
Now, okay, before we go, because that's a very interesting point. Why do you think it is that they can't imagine doing that?
Well, I think for the most part, leftists, whether they know it or not, are very invested in dividing us by race or gender or religion or whatever way they can do to divide us up into tribes so that they can control us and pit one of us against another. I think they're very invested in that. And they don't, if we really had racial harmony where there really was, you know, the races got along fine and didn't resent each other, mm-hmm. liberals wouldn't have anything to do. They wouldn't, they would never be able to get elected if that were true.
I could not have said it perfectly, more perfectly myself. Sorry, I have to get that grammar correct because you are, yes, Nick Searcy. You can follow him on Twitter at yes, Nick Searcy. And Nick.
An autograph picture with grammar like that, I'll tell you.
Right. And will you come back as we approach Gosnell movie, its release, and give us some more info on that?
Absolutely. You know, as it gets closer and we have more info and we know who's in it and, you know, all that stuff, I'd love to come back.
Absolutely. GosnellMovie.com. Nick, thanks so much for stopping by, brother. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Stephen. Good to talk to you.
If you like this video, subscribe by clicking my face. And if you hated it, well, join the club and you're going to hate this next video right next to me. But doesn't a part of you want to know what it is?